She was my pretty baby. She sure was my delight. With her beautiful, beady black eyes, I met her in Modesto in the middle of the night, when the old hotel burned down. Her name was Ida Lee. She stood blushing in a fright, with her beautiful beady black eyes. She had come from San Francisco just to pass the night, but the old hotel burned down. In her pinky nightgown, she stood a rosy sight, with her beautiful beady black eyes. I saved her from the flames in the middle of the night, in the old hotel burned down. She's still my pretty baby, though her hair is turning white, with her beautiful, beady black eyes. In our San Francisco home, we often laugh about the night when the old hotel burns.
This is Richard Roth, and this is The Passage. That was Lou Dar with a musical setting to a poem by James Broughton, who said, "Crazy old men are essential to society because young men need role models." If you'd like to learn more and see a clip from his film, The Bed, go to bigjoy.org. Well worth the effort. My guest today is Rodney Allen Greenblatt, another remarkable artist, sometime resident of Columbia County. You'll hear some music he has composed, Meditation, and a song by They Might Be Giants, Particle Man, and then James Broughton reading a poem. Here's the interview. I'm here with Rodney Allen Greenblatt, also known as Musho Rodney Allen Greenblatt, the artist. He started painting and drawing at the age of 3, and by 10 he had done his first public project, a catalog for the PTA. Rodney, Musho, welcome.
Thank you very much, Richard, for having me. It's fun to be here.
We met first in Hudson, but I've known your work for years from the Gracie Mansion Gallery, and you developed your mature style, one might say, fairly early on.
I guess so. I was a student at the School of Visual Arts, and I started kind of making these colorful, cartoony drawings, and I got a lot of response from them, so I just thought, I'll do that.
And when did you graduate from SVA?
In 82.
And then you immediately hit the scene in the East Village at that point. Had you shown with Gracie before you got out of school?
No, but at that time, the School of Visual Arts had an art gallery on Wooster Street. They had their own gallery. And I had two shows, once in a group show and one like a special project in the back of that gallery. And it was really wonderful. I was actually reviewed in Art News while I was still a student. Huh. So by the time I got out of school, I was already sort of on my way.
Now, were you living in the East Village at that time?
At that time, I lived with some friends at the Bowery in 4th Street. I guess that's the East Village, basically.
Right, the edge of the East Village.
Yeah. I moved to 9th Street and Avenue A a little while later.
And there was pretty much of a social scene there as well, right? I mean, everybody sort of seemed to know everyone.
Yeah, it was a big booming artist scene. It was still cheap over there, so it was easy to get a pretty inexpensive apartment. It was pretty rough and tumble in the East Village in the mid-80s. And yeah, there was a lot of energy.
A lot of vacant buildings and drug trafficking.
Disturbing things going on. But that was part of the fun, I suppose.
And then did you stay there pretty well for a fairly long time?
I guess I lived on 9th Street maybe up 4 years. And I ended up, as things picked up, I ended up getting a separate studio. I had one on Avenue B, and then I had one down at Walker Street. So I was living on 9th Street, and Dean and I were married, and when we had our kids, we had two little kids in 1985. We had two babies on 9th Street, and we realized 9th Street wasn't really working for us. It was a tiny little railroad apartment, so we moved a little after that.
I see. Now, where did you meet Dina?
Dean and I met at art school, at School of Visual Arts.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so we'd known each other a while.
And then you eventually ended up in Soho.
Yes, we did. We right after, when I realized how much rent I was paying for my Walker Street space combined with my 9th Street apartment, I realized we could probably afford to get a combined bigger space. And we found a funky, what at that time was on a dark and scary street, Crosby Street in Soho, which was still kind of an outback. I mean, it was picking up. That was like 87, mm-hmm. So it was picking up. And people thought I was crazy what I paid for the big, dingy loft that I bought. But, of course, now it's a totally different story.
And you're in the same loft
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. We've lived there all these years.
Now, when did you come up to Columbia County?
It's kind of roundabout. My mother-in-law had a house in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a little summer cottage. So we were coming up here with the kids to enjoy the Berkshires. And then Dina has a cousin in Ghent who has had a country house in Ghent for many years. So we would visit him. We sort of liked the area. And when it was time to get out of our little place in Pittsfield, we started looking down here. And we found a beautiful piece of property out in Ghent.
And the place was waiting for you with the studio and everything was already there?
No, it was also a pretty rough setup. Small little house on a big piece of land, just sitting sort of plopped in the middle of this big piece of land. But it had a nice barn that wasn't old. It was like a horse barn built in the 70s. I converted that to my studio. It wasn't a huge amount of renovation work to make it work.
And it was, of course, a beautiful setting there in Ghent.
Oh, yeah. It was. We really, after being in Pittsfield, we really wanted some privacy and a little open space. So we definitely got that in Ghent, which we really enjoyed thoroughly.
And you kept that then for?
We were there for about 13 years.
I see. And then somewhere during that time, you went off to Japan.
Well, I'd already started my Japan business before that. In the very late 80s, I met a man who was starting an agency to represent American artists in Tokyo for illustration. And eventually we became friends, and he started repping my work over there. So I've almost been doing that for 20 years now. It's maybe about 16 years I've been working with the same agent in Tokyo. And we've become great friends and have a lot of fun together doing crazy, bizarre advertising jobs and other things in Japan.
I noticed that you you did an album cover for the They Might Be Giants, and you also did one for a Japanese punk band.
Yes. I've done lots of album covers, and one of my very first jobs as an illustrator was in New York for They Might Be Giants. And it was a great match, and I met them and I thought they were great. I loved their music. So it was a really a good link. And it was a pretty famous album. It was their first album. So a lot of people bought it, I think. And it kind of put me on the map as an illustrator, which I didn't really think of myself as, but it sort of worked out well.
And then not too long after that, you also got into the Whitney Biennial, I think, in the mid-80s.
Yeah, right. In 1985, I was in the Whitney Biennial, and I was 25 years old. It was pretty amazing. I mean, I didn't even know what was happening around me. I mean, I was just, like, swept up in the whole, like, moment of it. I didn't really realize what an important part of my career it really was. I just thought it was great fun, and I loved all the attention. And it was a fun biennial with Keith Haring and all kinds of R.M. Fisher, you know, his work, and all kinds of great stuff in that show, wild and wacky stuff.
Did you do the piece specifically for that show?
No, I at that time my studio was on Avenue B, and I was starting to build some bigger pieces.
And this is a large piece, like 10 by 10 feet. Right?
Yeah, it was a big piece. I think I had it in a bit of production at the time. The curator was Patterson Sims. And he just loved it. He loved my funky, messed up studio. And he said, yeah, this piece, when it's done, will be perfect. So I built a great big tableau with lights and a mirror ball and little doors that opened. And it was a lot of fun. Windmills, and it was great.
The Arc of Triumph.
The Arc of Triumph, yeah, yeah. It's good. It was bought by a collector, and I think now it's owned by the University of Michigan Art Museum. I think they have it, which is great.
Later on, you started incorporating Buddhist imagery.
Well, that was much, much later on.
Much later.
I mean, I've had two other careers, actually, because in the mid-90s, the whole East Village art scene sort of fell apart by 1990.
What actually happened there? Everybody kind of moved over to Soho.
Everybody thought they should have bigger galleries and this should be a bigger business. I don't know what the mentality of it all was, but everybody moved to Broadway. There were lots of spaces down in Soho and Broadway that were upstairs opened and being rented for upstairs galleries. Right, but it was kind of a disaster. I think the rents were a little too high. And there was a bit of an economic crash, I think, in 90?
Right,
91 or 92, something like that.
Right, about that, right. There was something about the architecture of it. It wasn't quite right also, it seemed.
And the galleries were too big for what our usual East Village way of doing things was. It was really do-it-yourself. This is the way, at least, I mean, Gracie was a great dealer, but we were all involved in figuring out what to do and making it work. When we got into that big space with all that, there was a lot more at stake with those kind of rents. I don't know, but it didn't work. Let's cut to it. It really didn't work out. And after that, I got involved in computers and making computer art.
Now tell me about that.
Well, I had been fooling around with the Macintosh all along, and I started making these children's CD-ROM. Well, I didn't know who they were for. I was just making these experimental like CD-ROM projects. And I got linked up with this company called Voyager. They were like pioneers of interactive multimedia. I mean, before there was the internet, they were already making these like informational and also edutainment works for CD-ROM. So I made a few CD-ROMs for this company in the mid-90s.
And those were animated?
They were animated and musical. So I used my bit of music skill and my bit of animation skill to make these funky, arty things.
You do a basic drawing and the computer is sort of able to make it move around? How did that work?
Well, at that time, it was really still a matter of making a different still for each frame. Oh. I mean, they were 2D animations. I didn't do 3D, so it was pretty much making individual frames. So there are all kinds of tricks that the computer let you do. And somehow I was able to do it. I loved the computer, and I had a good sense of it, so it wasn't so hard. But that's what led me to start. I was then later on, because of that, and actually not connected to Voyager, but I was hired by Sony to work on a video game in the mid-90s. they liked my CD-ROM characters and what I had done for Voyager, and then they wanted to know if I could work as a character designer for a video game for PlayStation.
I explained that, a character designer.
Well, I didn't know what a character designer was at the time, but they had already an idea for a game for this brand new machine called PlayStation, which they were sure was going to be a success. And they needed someone to design the characters in the world for this guy's music game. There was kind of a Simon Says sort of thing where you had to follow the sort of one character does one thing and you have to follow the pattern. And this game was called Parappa the Rapper.
Oh.
And it was a huge hit. The game series was finished in 2001. We did two sequels. We were pretty much done. But it's kind of kept alive. Licensing for the character, and actually there's going to be a game. Okay, this is some new information. It's going to come out in a game this fall. Like a battle game between like PlayStation characters. PlayStation characters from all different games in the past, they're battling it out with each other. And it's really funny because one of the characters is my funky cartoon character, Parappa. But he's battling like ogres with battle axes and army men with like Gatling guns and things.
So these are all in different styles of drawing.
Yeah, all these different styles like battling it out in this game. So it's going to be good for my character, who hasn't really been in a game for almost 10 years now.
Now, you still go to Japan.
Yep, I'm still busy with that.
And what do you do over there?
I do a lot of illustration work for Japanese companies. There's always a demand in Japan for cute character stuff to sell products. So I've done some great stuff. I've done some great stuff for different companies in Japan. That's just one aspect of what I do over there. I also show with a print gallery that publishes artist prints, and they have it's like a mall art gallery. They have many, many locations in shopping malls and department stores, so they sell prints. The print gallery job is fun. We come out with a series of prints, maybe three or four every year, and then I get to do a little tour, kind of a signing tour.
So you go to these various...
I go to these various shopping malls in Japan and department stores, and I sit there at a table, and I meet all the fans who love my
which
work.
Which must be great, because Japanese kids are so stylish and hip and everything, right?
Yeah, and so many, actually a lot of young artists, young art students come out to see me, and it's very different. I mean, the equivalent here would be like a book signing. Or maybe like pop stars in a record store or something like that. It's kind of like that. And I get to meet the fans, and we have a lot of fun. And it's good for the stores. They get a lot of business.
Uh-huh.
So I've been doing this for about 5 years. Sure. And I sign the prints that they buy, but also I sign anything. I sign people's mobile phones and their T-shirts and their laptops, and I sign their grandmother's vase. Anything that they bring in, they're like, Rodney-san, please... sign my grandmother's vase. She just died. Like, sign that too. Why not?
Now, the last few years you've been showing in Hudson,
yeah.
The BCD Gallery.
Yes.
Well, did you know Bruce from New York, or you met here? How did that come about?
I met Bruce up here, actually. I was, when I got my studio together up here, I didn't have representation in New York, so I just thought, you know, it'd be fun to show in Hudson. There's like a gallery scene. And I sent out I made like little brochures of my work, and I took it around to some of the galleries. And I got a lot of good responses. They knew my work. Most of the people who operate galleries in Hudson have some New York City background. So they knew my work. And Bruce just thought it would be fun. So I've been working with him for quite a while, maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yes. So now you work in Soho.
Yeah, I'm back in New York City. Yes, I had to. We loved Ghent, but it was just so hard to have two places. And with all the traveling and everything else, I just realized it just was too hard to manage them both. One of them had to go, and we decided to sell our place in Ghent, which was sad, but also it's been kind of a relief. So I'm back in New York City.
You do come up... every so often.
Yeah, we come up a lot. It's actually great. We stay in bed and breakfasts. There's all kinds of great bed and bed and breakfast places hidden around here. And it's always an experience. And we rent a car. And it's really, really fun, actually, without the overhead of having your own country house that needs tons of work and everything else. It's really been fun. So we're doing that this weekend, actually.
Do you find that your work is different at all in New York as opposed to the kind of work you would do out here?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know yet. I'm just, like, getting back to work in New York City. And I am going to have a show in Hudson next spring 2013. And I'm just starting to make new work. So I'm very excited about that. I'll keep you posted on the dates when they arise. Bruce is excited about it.
In about 2007, you said, you started putting some Buddhist imagery in your work.
Yeah, right.
That was because you had gradually become interested in Buddhism? You said you started going to the Zendo around that time.
I've always had a kind of a back of the mind interest in Zen, and I've always been curious about it, and I've been to Japan so many times, I've been to many temples, and I thought about it a lot, but I never got any answers. Like, when I asked my friends in Japan what it was about, they just sort of changed the subject. So I realized I'm going to have to find out about this for myself. And it's kind of funny because that's one of the things that Zen is sort of about. It's like finding it out for yourself, you know, what is your experience? So I started going to this wonderful place in Soho called the Village Zendo. You can look it up online. It's villagezendo.org. And it's a meditation space, and they have some nice teachers. There's some actual Zen masters involved in the operation. They're wonderful. And I've really found myself in so many ways there. I do a lot of work for them. I do artwork for them, and I'm kind of the sound engineer there. I put their PA system together, and I help them do all kinds of stuff. I put a lot of volunteer time into the Zendo and meditation time, and I'm really enjoying it. And it has definitely spilled over into my artwork.
Now, the Zendo, where is that located, actually?
It's on the 11th floor of a building right at Broadway and Houston. So it's actually 588 Broadway.
In your last show, or maybe the second to the last show at BCB, you had a very large, like 4x4 foot Buddha image.
Yeah, I've really been enjoying that. I think all artists struggle with, like, well, what is my art about? Like, is a lot of artists now are working with process and social commentary. There's so many things you could make your work about if you even care. And I kind of wondered about that. When I started practicing Zen, I realized that this is really something that means something to me, that I care about. So I sort of thought I might experiment and see what that would be like in my artwork, which is such a funky, colorful, upbeat thing. Zen doesn't seem funky and upbeat, but it does have that aspect. At least I see it that way. So I thought maybe it would be interesting for people and definitely for myself to start making some kind of Zen and Buddhist-inspired imagery. And there's such a rich history of it. You know, when I started looking into what's been done and look at some of these amazing, like, Tibetan paintings and old stuff from India, the colors and everything are all there. It's wacky, a lot of it. I mean, there's like, most people have like 11 arms and
right.
Stuff like that.
Right.
So like, there's no, I'm not really breaking any new ground in a funny way. I'm just sort of picking up maybe where lots of our other artists had experimented in the past. And I feel really good about that.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, Thailand, they'll build a new temple and decorate it inside. And you'll see sort of a heavy metal style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be practically anything.
Yeah. I'm right there with that. I mean, maybe if I was born in Thailand, I'd be like designing temples and putting like heavy metal guitar imagery in the background somewhere. I'm very at home with that. In fact, if you wanted me to get started on that right away, I think I could do that. But I'm seeing how it goes, and I'm enjoying it. So I'm going to have a lot of Buddhist stuff in my new show. I've already got some pieces going.
Now the Thunder Bunny.
Thunder Bunny.
Thunder Bunny is one of the characters from your video games, right?
Thunder Bunny was actually a kind of a licensing character. Like, we made a this in the mid-90s, I was working for Sony, and they needed some characters to sell, I don't know, what they, printing them on lunch boxes and calendars and diary books and stuff, printed stuff. They needed some cute, something cute for girls. So I had already had this character I had made for a children's book called Thunder Bunny. And I'd kind of, it wasn't a character at first that I really cared about expanding, but they loved it. So they really did a lot with Thunder Bunny. And as I was kind of asked to do more Thunder Bunny books and more Thunder Bunny merchandise, it kind of, I sort of expanded that character. And he's kind of a benevolent spirit, I've discovered.
Now, those books are in Japanese?
The later ones were bilingual in Japanese and English. Then at the very last one, I decided to do it with no words. I thought that would be the solution to the translation problem, just no words. But it didn't exactly work. Then people were like, well, what is this book about? So I don't know if that it was an noble experiment that I tried.
How many children's books have you done?
I guess I've done about 6 or 7 over the years. Yeah. In the early 90s, I was made some, you know, solid children's books for HarperCollins publishers. And they sold all right.
Now, these, in this case, you're writing the stories as well.
Yeah.
The narrative.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. The last Thunder Bunny one's called Thunder Bunny Nature, and it's definitely my it's kind of like Thunder Bunny's Enlightenment is basically what it is. If you ever get to see it, actually, Bruce has a few copies of it in the gallery if you want to take a look. And I have some of it online, maybe on my website. But, yeah, it kind of became this sort of Enlightenment story without words, which I thought made sense to me. That was a problem.
Now, the earlier ones, did you use your own kids as a kind of a target audience, or how did you?
Oh, yeah. In the very beginning, yeah, when I was making, yeah, it was real typical. Like, my kids were reading books, and I said, oh, I want to make a children's book. And so I started, I read it for them, and they responded, and they were really great help. My kids are both artists. They don't work as artists, but they're very talented, and they helped me kind of, they're kind of like fact checkers or something. They're very exacting. They were very exacting about my drawings. They would point out things, inconsistencies and things in my artwork, which I always thought was great. They both had such a good eye for this stuff.
You seem to me like a hardworking guy. You spend a lot of time working.
It doesn't seem like working for me. I've been so blessed to like be able to do the things I love to do. So when people say, you know, do you work a lot? I don't feel like I do. I'm just like enjoying myself and experimenting. I mean, the deadlines for the illustration work can be pretty grinding. But that's just the nature of it, right? It has to be done, like at a certain time or for them to use it. And they're, you know, some of these things they pay a lot of money for, especially when there's an advertising agency involved. So sometimes I get pretty tired of doing like some of these heavy illustration jobs, but they're great.
Are you doing studio work in Japan too when you're traveling?
Not lately. Lately, for the past like 3 or 4 years, I've pretty much just been doing commercial work in Japan.
How long a period of time will you spend there on a trip?
I go twice a year, and I usually stay for 2 weeks. I think anything under 2 weeks is too exhausting to like adjust to the time and everything. 2 weeks seems to be working out well.
And you're traveling around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I start out in Tokyo. My agent's office is in Tokyo, so that's our home base. And lately, I have been doing a really wonderful illustration series. Well, not really. It's kind of like a character design job in Kyushu, in the southern big island of Japan. And there's a beautiful city there called Fukuoka, and I'm working for the Japanese railroad train, the JR, the Japanese railroad, designing a character for their like swipe card, like the card you use to get in.
Oh.
It has my character on it in Kyushu. So it's been a nice job.
Have you been anywhere near the areas that were affected by the tidal wave?
Yes, I was. Right after the disaster, I had already been scheduled to go up and do a signing in Sendai, which is very close to where the tsunami hit, and it's in Fukushima, which is actually where the nuclear plant is. And I was so I was not worried about it at all. I thought, at least my Zen training has made me realize, like, this can happen anywhere at any time, you know. Worrying about it doesn't help the situation at all, so I just went. And they were so happy to see me when I got to Sendai. I did my book signing, or my print signing, as I always do, but there were, like, a lot of happy tears. It was just like, thank you for coming here, was their basic attitude, because we feel disconnected, you know? They were really feeling like no one would ever go to Fukushima again, Fukushima Prefecture again. And they are wonderful. And the place is, like, totally back together. I mean, leave it to Japanese technology to, like, put a city that was shaken with an 8-point-something earthquake. Like, within 6 months, the place was back in operation, and it looked great. So, yeah, I was there, and I was trying to bring a few smiles back to that place.
Do you have fans that you recognize?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do. We have a group. We call them the Super Fans. They travel all over the place.
Like the Grateful Dead.
It's not on that scale. There's really, like, about 6 of them. Or maybe 10. And they'll travel. I mean, they'll, like, go to Kyushu from, like, Osaka or something. I mean, that's a big trip. I mean, you got to get on the train, and, you know, it takes 5 hours or something. They'll come down, or longer, to come down and see me, some of them. And sometimes we have tea with them. We kind of give them some special treatment if they've come, like, hundreds of miles. So that's fun. Yeah, I've gotten to know them over the years.
Do you speak Japanese?
No, I don't. I have tried everything. I have taken private lessons. I've gone to the Japan Society in New York City repeatedly. And it just isn't happening for me. And last year I was taking private lessons, and I decided to give up. And it was such a relief, finally, just to say to myself, you know what? This isn't going to happen for me. And I have so much work to do and so many things I love doing, and studying Japanese language is not one of them. And I was really relieved. So I quit. I leave it to my wife studies Japanese. She's doing really well. So I'm leaving it to her and the translators. And my friends in Japan speak English, so I don't have to worry about it. It was just a fantasy, I think.
Well, now, did you ever study other languages?
No.
So maybe it's just not your thing.
I mean, it's just not my thing. I mean, I feel like I have a hard time with English, basically. So I had a bad education.
Well, I guess you were kind of more interested in visual from such an early age.
It's true. I really was. Words have never really been my thing. So I just wanted to try, you know. I thought it would be... Wouldn't it be great if I could just, like, start speaking in Japanese? Wow, that would be amazing. But it's not going to happen.
It's a pretty difficult language.
Very, very difficult. There's many layers to it, so it's okay.
Do you still have your Model T?
Yes, I have an antique car that I grew up with. My father restored this 1924 Model T Ford. It took him about 40 years to get it together, so my whole childhood I saw this thing being built, painstakingly put together. Then when I moved to Ghent, he asked me if I wanted it. And I said yes. I didn't know what I was getting into, but I said yes. And I took care of it and put it back in. It had sat around in his garage in D.C. for a while, so it was sort of in bad shape. Oh, well, it looks great, but it was kind of not in running shape. So I put it into running shape, and I used to drive it around Ghent, which is a perfect place. If you're a classic car person, Columbia County's great. There's lots of back roads, and
it's a sort of an open roadster.
Yeah, it's a touring car with a convertible roof. it's quite a contraption. I don't recommend it.
Did you start it with a crank?
No. Luckily, in 1924, they had an electric starter as an option. It probably cost $5 extra, which I'm sure at the time was a lot of money. So I have an electric starter, thank goodness.
Now, you were born in San Francisco.
That's right.
Where did you grow up?
I lived in Daly City, California, outside of San Francisco until I was 10. And then we moved to Bethesda, Maryland. And I lived in Bethesda, Maryland until I was 17 years old. Then I moved to New York City.
As a student?
As a student, yeah. I still go back to San Francisco once in a while. My brother lives in San Jose, and I have relatives in the Bay Area, so I go over there. I love it.
So you first came to the area. You were going to Pittsfield.
Yeah.
And that was the late 80s?
Yeah, that was late 80s, early 90s.
And so you've seen Hudson go through its latest renaissance.
When we got to Ghent, I didn't know much about Hudson when we first saw our place. We had looked for a house for more than a year, and we found our place in Ghent. And when we discovered that it was really quite close to Hudson, we started like visiting Hudson. And it's easy to fall in love with Hudson, even with all its ups and downs. And it's certainly, if we got there in 95, I guess, or something like that, it certainly has had its ups and downs since then. But it's always exciting. It's a very dynamic place. It might have a bad season, but then it can bounce back so easily. People come in and buy buildings and open up things, and you never know. And it's really, that's one of the things that's great about it. There's opportunities here, for sure. And the gallery scene, the art scene is rich. There's all kinds of things, and there's heavy New York City link, so the caliber of the artwork is really quite good. So I was really happy to be able to be included in the sort of Hudson culture. And it's a small town, too. You can know a lot of people, which is really kind of exciting. I never had that small town experience since I lived in, Bethesda's just like a big suburban, typical suburban Washington, D.C. community. It's not like, it doesn't have a small town flavor at all. So that was kind of a new experience for me. And in Pittsfield, we lived out. It was just like a country house on the lake. So it was, we were not really, I didn't feel like I was such a part of what was happening in Pittsfield. But Hudson is really great. It offers a lot, I think. A lot of great people are here.
Now, at that time, I guess in 95, TSL was going.
Yeah, and we loved it. And Linda and Claudia are just amazing. They really welcomed us. And there was a lot of stuff for us to see, We didn't feel... I think our fantasy at first was to get away from it all. Like when we got to Ghent, no one's going to be around. Isn't that going to be great? But like, it wasn't too long before we were like, I wonder what's going on at that TSL place. Let's go and see a movie there. So we used to go to the movies there, and we got to know Linda and Claudia a little bit and just loving everything they did. And they transformed their neighborhood. I mean, they are just a force over there, and they're still at it. That is one of the things I miss now that I'm back in the city is... kind of following along what's going on at TSL and visiting them. And I would definitely say to people, if you haven't been over there, you got to go over and see what they're doing at TSL. There's always something good.
And of course now we have Marina Abramovich is moving in across the street.
I know.
It's a sort of an entertainment district on Columbia Street.
I know.
Club Helsinki.
I know. Very alternative too. It's not your typical entertainment district. It's great. I'm really excited. And so you got some new restaurants coming in. So this season's really doing well. I'm happy to see it.
Have you tried the very newest one now called the Crimson Sparrow?
No, we've heard all about it, but we have not had a chance to go there yet, but I think we will.
I'm sure that Dina is going to find it interesting.
Yeah, Dina, my wife, is really into food, and she follows this kind of stuff. She knows who the players are over there, so we'll definitely check it out. It should be great.
So Dina has a food catering business.
She's not exactly a she's done some catering for nonprofits through the Zend connections from the Zendo and to some other friends. So she knows how to do the catering thing, but it's not really her central focus these days. But she can do it, and she's an amazing cook.
I had the pleasure of eating some of her concoctions, actually.
I know. She is amazing. So it's another blessing for me. My wife is this amazing, creative food artist, basically, which is really wonderful. So maybe we'll get her to make something for the opening at VCB next year.
Are you a vegetarian?
Yeah, I'm a vegetarian. We're both vegetarians. We've been that way. We've done that for many years. So she's kind of a master at coming up with amazing things that you don't even notice are without meat.
So would you have any thoughts as to how Hudson should... proceed, carry on? What's the future of Hudson?
Gosh, I'm not sure I could predict the future of Hudson, but I think, you know, I think people are looking for sustainable communities of some sort. It's hard to even fathom in our super mass market, you know, crazy America that we're living in right now. It's hard to imagine how you could even do that. But I think in a smaller community like Hudson, you kind of can. You can find farms and you can find people and jobs in the area, and it's tough, but I think it's doable. It's doable in Hudson. I think people try it and succeed to some extent or another to sort of have a localized existence and live their life a little more on a smaller scale. I think it's possible here.
Now, do you feel a connection to the New York art world these days?
You know, I feel very disconnected, actually. I went to the Whitney Biennial this time, and I really feel like I didn't get it. I didn't know what was really going on. And I always loved the Whitney Biennial. But this one, I just felt like I was on the outside. I don't know why exactly, what it was about the artwork that was so different from maybe 2 years ago. But I don't know. I really don't know what's happening in Chelsea and how the operation is going these days. And I'm not worried about it, actually. It's, you know, whatever. They're doing what they do. It's a system they have, and if I ever get back into that system, that would be nice. But if I don't, that'll be okay too, I think. And I think you kind of have to have that attitude about it.
There seems to be sort of an alternative scene developing around the Bowery nowadays, right?
Oh, yeah, in the Lower East Side, yeah, there's lots of little alternative galleries and things happening. But they're not so alternative, really. I think they seem to be, you know, just mimicking or something or following the system that is usually followed with art, big involved art galleries. I don't know much about it, really. But it is kind of exciting down there. There's some good stuff to be seen.
Do you keep up with music, contemporary music?
Yeah, I do. I listen to all kinds of music. I like to listen while I'm working. I'm a big fan of WFMU in New Jersey. Their crazy stuff is great. I listen to them. And they always play something new and different. And I make music, too.
Is there any of your music on your website or links to it?
Yeah, actually, there are links to it on my website. I worked on a CD of my own in Japan in 2007. No, before that. Is on iTunes. Another one I did on my own later, actually. The 2007 one I had produced myself, just of kind of experimental synthesizer meanderings.
Oh, did you have music training?
No, I didn't. I took piano lessons when I was five or something like that. My parents made me. But I've never been a much of a music student, but I love improvising and experimenting. And with computers have really sort of sparked my imagination with music. So I've been making some synthesized music for fun.
And your family obviously always encouraged you in your artwork.
Oh yeah, from the beginning. I don't know how they recognized that at three that I should be outfitted with a beret and a palette. I don't know what made them do that because I was just, you know, a little kid. But somehow they saw that energy in me, and they just like kept me supplied with brushes and pans of paint and whatever I needed.
I guess they saw that you loved what you were doing, and so...
I guess so. I mean, that's really wonderful for parents to recognize that. And I was lucky that they did. So I always had at least this small amount of materials. And we grew up, it was, you know, typical suburban kind of a setup, nothing extravagant. But, you know, I had my pads of paper and my pens, and I could take an art class if I wanted to.
And were you the guy at the school who did the visual stuff?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I was the art class, art room. I don't know what you call it. The guy who's always in the art room. I didn't do any other school work, which was a disaster. But I made all kinds of great stuff. I did the posters for the school play, and I did all that kind of stuff for the art fair.
To get into SVA, do you have to submit a portfolio?
Yeah, that was not a problem for me. I had tons of stuff already that I had made in high school. I've been at it the whole time, and I'd had commercial jobs even then, even in high school, getting paid to do little stuff for people. So it's been great. I've really basically been doing the same thing since fourth grade. In fact, I often tell this story of how I was asked. They wanted me to do like an art, like kind of an agricultural poster with like farming, and I drew all these sheep. And the sheep were really cute. And this was in fourth grade, so I was about 10 years old. And a lot of these, the people I knew, I met later on at like a reunion. And they were like, I remember those sheep you did. They were so cute. And at that time of the reunion, I was working on a video game project that involved a sheep character. So like 25 years later, I was still working on like cute sheep. It was such a weird connection, but it was absolutely true. So I've pretty much been doing the same job since I was 10 years old. Well, I've been very lucky in that way.
Well, is there anything else you would like to say?
Anything else I would like to say? I'm honored to be here and to participate in the culture here in Hudson. It's really wonderful. And New York City is so big and awesome, and it's easy to get lost. It really is. And it's easy to even think, oh, I'm never going to make it here. Or see your career change and wonder, you know, what am I doing wrong? And none of that stuff is actually necessary, but New York City kind of brings that on. You know, it's always just massive and ever-changing. So the opportunities that I've had in Hudson have really been helpful to me. And I'm really lucky to have stumbled onto this wonderful community here, and I'm very grateful. So coming out to my show next spring, and I'll be there, and I'll, if you want me to draw a funny sheep on your cell phone, I'll do it.
You're signing grandma's days.
Exactly. Whatever you want me to sign, I'll definitely do it. I got my Sharpie, so I'll do that for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Particle Man, Particle Man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle Man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle Man. Triangle Man, Triangle Man, Triangle Man hates Particle Man. They have a fight, Triangle wins, Triangle Man. Universe Man, Universe Man, size of the entire universe, man. Usually kind to smaller man. Universe Man, he's got a watch with a minute hand, millennium hand, and a beyond hand. And when they meet, it's a happy land. Powerful man, Universe Man. Person Man, hit on the head with a frying pan. Lives his life in a garbage can. Person Man. Is he depressed or is he a mess? Does he feel totally worthless? Who came up with Person Man? Degraded man, Person Man. Triangle Man, Triangle Man, Triangle Man hates Person Man. They have a fight, Triangle wins, Triangle Man.
This is an homage to Lao Tzu called the Water Circle. Down and up they go, the waters that always flow, the rivers that open their veins to the sea and then return as snow. Down from arterial hills, their circulation spills, the heart of the lake refills, and down in the valley the river will sing as it refreshes everything, high or low, fast or slow, from head to toe, scenery, machinery, and makes the poppy grow. It wakens a sleeping tree, it sets the salmon free, and then flows down and down through field and town to drown in a briny shroud and resurrect into a cloud. From brook to hurricane, the changing waters remain. They freeze and flood and evaporate, and then return in rain. The generous torrent pours green gifts on all outdoors, uplifts the reservoirs, and out of the faucet the river will run as it refreshes everyone, high and low, friend or foe, from head to toe, swashing in or washing out, and makes the baby grow. It lubricates the blood, it moves the human mud, and then descends and ends inside the tide to lay in the ocean's hand the sacrifices of the land. Oh, there's a time when streams run dry and every road blankets in dust, when ponds are parched with alkali, leaving the trout nonplussed. When there's an oven in the sky that blackens the meadow's crust, and when in drought the only wet is tear or sweat and old souvenirs of rust. But down again they'll flow, the waters that come and go, the rivers that bubble their bounty away and send it back in snow. Leaping from mountain heights, the juice of heaven unites all living appetites. And down in the valley it gurgles along, liquidating right and wrong, high and low and status quo, from head to toe, reveling in leveling and making apples grow. Up and down it comes and goes and dies in the bed of the sea. Up it snows and down it flows, and so it shall always be.